Hi, this is Noel Rappin with my book club, I guess. I'm recording audio of some of my blog posts, and I've started doing these monthly book review posts and catching up. So I thought I would record this. This is going to be a little bit looser than some of the other posts, just because I'm probably going to improvise a little bit more off the text, and we'll go from there. We'll see. This is January 2026's Books of the Month, posted in a timely fashion on May 31st, 2026. I've been doing these book review posts here for a pretty long time, and I love doing them, but the end of year posts are somewhat time intensive. And I finally remembered the XP approach to work intensive practices, which is to do the job more frequently and in smaller bursts. So I've been doing that. I've been writing reviews of books as I go, but editing my initial rambling into this rambling is what takes most of the time. Don't tell anybody, but I am secretly hoping this will get me to write more in general. Ground rules. I am not writing about everything I read. I'm not interested in writing publicly about books I didn't like, and sometimes I just don't have anything to say, even about books I like. That said, this should end up with me writing about more books overall than I do at the end of the year post, which will still exist, but it will probably be shorter, but who knows. Books are listed in the order that I read them because that's the order my drafts are in, and there's a potentially a little bit of a storyline. I'm giving my score using the baseball-based system that I explained in the 2025 book post and the StoryGraph score as of May 31st, 2026. And I force-raked mine, and that's more exposition than you probably care about. We are starting up with January 2026, a month that featured more Dungeon Crawler Carl, Dracula on a spaceship, and a woman who can talk to pots and pans. I read 11 books in January, and I am talking about 8 of them. Here goes. We'll lead off with The Butcher's Masquerade by Matt Dinneman, which is book 5 of Dungeon Crawler Carl. StoryGraph's score of 4.58, which was first of the 11 books that I read this month on StoryGraph, and my score was a double. I ranked it 3rd of the 11 books that I read this month. I put this in the 2025 recap, but it only took 5 books for me to realize that Dungeon Crawler Carl has roughly the same energy as Battlefield Earth. Earth has been conquered by much more powerful aliens. Some random dude decides to destroy them starting from nothing with just pluck, luck, and leverage. Anyway, book 5. I appreciate that Dinneman is, to some extent, taking the consequences of this premise seriously, mostly just how messed up the galaxy needs to be for this dungeon crawl to even exist. The books are getting very lore-heavy. There are a few times here where there's a callback to an earlier book that isn't fully explained, and I expect that eventually I will need to read this book with a fan wiki at hand or something. That said, the book is pretty tense. For as long as it is, Dinneman does a pretty good job of keeping the stakes clear. He's starting to go for the here's the plan fade to black technique a lot, especially for a series that is mostly in first-person narration. Still, though, you can see Dinneman getting better and better as like a writer, and the structure of the book's getting better as the series moves on. Next up, The Keeper of Magical Things by Julie Leong. StoryGraph had this at 4.24, 3rd of 11. I had this as also a double, but the best book I read in January. First line of this is, Certainty Bulrush was in the midst of arguing with a particularly intractable quilt. Our point of view character, Certainty, is a novice mage with the ability to talk to objects. Well, I guess anybody can talk to objects, but they talk back to Certainty. Her other magical skills are somewhat lacking, so she is stuck with no clear path to becoming a full mage. Through one thing and another, she finds herself assigned to the least magical town in the entire realm, helping to create a storehouse of magical junk that the mages need to store someplace safe. She's accompanied by Aurelia, a mage with a reputation as an ice queen, and Aurelia, of course, has some secrets of her own. You mostly know where this book is going, but the journey's fun. Will they find the perfect artifacts to wake up the sleeping and depressing little town? Will they fall for each other? No spoilers. Wink. But it's all really charming. The interactions with the objects are super well done. It's got a certain kind of let's put on a show adjacent energy, and I like the ending actually a lot. That's 2 really solid books for Leong, who is becoming a good candidate for my informal authors whose next decade of books are exciting me list. This book made me want to talk about genre, although admittedly almost every book makes me want to talk about genre. Wait, I have a section header. We're going to be doing this a lot. Marketed as. The marketing blurb for this book calls it a charming novel and does not use the words romance or fantasy or cozy. Granted, it does say there's magic, so I guess fantasy is probably implied. What is it, though? Romance actually has an official definition, at least according to the Romance Writers of America, who I guess would know. And that definition is, 2 basic elements comprise every romance novel, a central love story and an emotionally satisfying and optimistic ending. Whether this book is a romance by that definition depends on how you define central. The romance plot and the plot are very close to 50-50 in this book. Normally, I'd look to which plot drives the ending that the writer wants you to see as the true victory, but actually both plots resolve at the same time with the same action, which is honestly pretty nicely done. It's definitely a fantasy. We've got magic and mages and everything, and I guess technically you could call it a romantasy, but if you're looking for deeply angsty enemy-to-lover action, this is not the droid you're looking for, so to speak. I guess there is kind of enemies to lovers, but it's not really deeply angsty and dark in that sense. Anyway, it is interesting that the publisher is not marketing it as romantasy. On my cozy scale from last year, it scores like about a 7 or 8 out of 10, so I guess this is really cozy fantasy, and that's probably more than this discussion can bear. This book grew on me over time, and I do think it's clearly my favorite book of January. It's really fun. It's maybe a hair long in Act 3. I think I would have liked the romance plot to be a little more centered. Aurelia has a magic necklace that is kind of a very interesting character plot bit in a fantasy, lets you make a metaphor concrete kind of way. Overall, really worked for me. Next up, 1929 by Andrew Ross Sorkin. Storygraph has this as a 3.95. It was 7th. I had it as a single and also had it as 7th of my 11 this month. It's not really marketed as anything in particular, except as being by, I guess, Andrew Ross Sorkin. I do wish nonfiction books had blurbs that said things like, "For fans of House of Morgan and the Money Stuff newsletter." I did learn a lot from this book. A couple of semi-random notes. Pacing narrative nonfiction is hard. This book has two problems. The first, which is kind of endemic to the genre, is a problem with interrupting the flow. The narrative will have a line like, "With steely resolve, John Doe walked into the room," followed by, "Born in 1880, Doe came from a long line," and then we get two pages of John Doe backstory that brings the narrative to a halt. But the alternative is not giving the reader the full weight of what it means that John Doe walked into the room. It's a hard problem. The second is kind of more specific to this book. The book's very vignette-based, and at the end of the day, I feel like I kind of missed a sense of the overall sweep of what happened while we got kind of caught up in the tangles of a handful of bankers. It starts very early, though, which does put the October 1929 crash in context really well. But how do you do a book like this, title the chapters by date, and not have a chapter titled October 29th, 1929? It's really neat, though, that a lot of people involved are legendary names that are still companies to this day that we think of as companies that were actually people. Merrill, Lynch, Morgan, Fox, even David Sarnoff, who didn't become a company but was sort of synonymous with his company. He's in this narrative. We have a quote, "Gambling on stocks had replaced drinking as a legal intoxicant," unquote. But maybe the wildest thing that I learned in this book was that public issue polling wasn't really a thing in 1932, but to the extent that it was, Hoover lost to FDR, not over the economy. Voters largely saw kind of a recovery in 1932 and may have even been skeptical of what FDR planned to do, but over prohibition, which Hoover supported and FDR voted to end, which is wild. Next up, There Is No Anti-Mimetics Division by Quantum, QNTM. Storygraph had this at 4.06, 6th out of 11. I had it as a single, 5th out of 11. It was a close call. It was almost a double. I might change my mind. It was, you know, sort of on the border, thrown out trying to stretch a single to a double, to stretch a metaphor. You can think of this as the Rook plus the Laundry Files divided by 2 with a little bit more darkness. It's marketed as, quote, "a whip-smart tale of science fiction horror," unquote, which isn't bad. The blurb ends with, "Welcome to the Anti-Mimetics Division. No, this is not your first day," which is honestly outstanding. The setup here is that we are following the Unknowables organization, and specifically the Anti-Mimetics Division. An anti-meme is an idea that steals memories. Of course, one problem with a division studying anti-memes is that everybody tends to forget what they are working on. The first, like, 60% of this book is a mix of vignettes and reports about various anti-mimetic objects with clearly some ongoing story going on in the background. At about the 60% mark, everything blows up, and we spend the rest of the book resolving the plot. It's probably worth noting that this all started as kind of a fan fiction on a website called SCP Foundation, which is kind of a collaborative fiction about... Well, any description I give about what the SCP Foundation is will be inadequate. You should look it up if this sounds interesting. I think the first half of the book is more successful. It's weird but manageable, and the memory games are comprehensible. It's a lot like a darker version of the Rook books, and I like the way the format switches around. The second part, well, I think there's a point at which when you state that you are describing ideas that are beyond human conception, it's pretty hard to describe them in such a way that is within human conception. So there's a lot here that you kind of have to take on faith. To some extent, this is true of a lot of science fiction and fantasy, but there's a point beyond which that's hard to sustain. The thing about, for example, Case Nightmare Green in the Laundry series is that Charlie Strauss is pretty careful to make his Eldritch nightmares have to fit in a human brain, and he's also pretty clear that Case Nightmare Green is unavoidable and undefeatable. On the whole, I did like this, but I'm not sure it's for everybody. The people who it is for, though, are going to love it. Next up, The Treasure Hunters Club by Tom Ryan. Storygraph had this as 3.68, 11th out of 11. I had it as a double, 4th out of 11, so you see we have a little bit of a split here. Per the blurb, quote, "Everyone in my family has killed someone meets the Goonies," unquote. That's fair. I take that to mean somewhat low-stakes mystery with twists and something like a treasure plot. Yeah, it's got a little bit of Western game DNA, too. This is a weird one because it got a lot of good reviews in general and was an Edgar Award nominee at the Mystery Novel Awards, but its Storygraph score is real low given that. This is the biggest gap between Storygraph rank and my rank this month. My guess is that it's two things. One, as an award nominee, the book was probably read by some people outside of its natural audience. And two, I think twist-based mysteries are kind of inherently divided. Wait, just follow me down a rabbit hole for a second. This book was nominated for something called the Lillian Jackson Braun Memorial Award, which is given to a contemporary cozy mystery, which you know I couldn't help trying to figure out. The website actually lists the criteria. The main ones are contemporary, amateur detective with no training, emphasis on being part of a community, sex and violence are off-page, and it is light in tone and often humorous. Mostly sounds like my thing, so I'll be looking to use that list as a reading guide. Anyway, the main characters here are three people who wind up in a small coastal town in Nova Scotia for different reasons. There's a 15-year-old girl who grew up there, a struggling author who is house-sitting, and the long-lost grandson of the richest family in town. They all get caught up in a local mystery, buried pirate treasure, never found. And then there are a few mysterious deaths, and, well, we got a novel. I mostly like this. The vibes are good, and it carries itself through might otherwise be a kind of a slow burn setup pretty well. There's a big, big twist at about the 75% mark, which is maybe right on the edge of fair play, and I suspect it turned off a lot of people and mostly thought it worked. Amazon reviews call it choppy, which might be code for the three stories don't intertwine the way we want. But the pacing at the end is genuinely weird. It's tense for about 5 seconds and then it's over. There's also a trope at the very, very end that I genuinely dislike, but it'd be a spoiler to say that Redacted does something unilateral with Redacted. That's the kind of thing that only happens in books, not the word Redacted, the thing that's actually being redacted. You get it. Next up, Inside Threat by KB Spangler. Storygraph had this at 4.32, 2nd out of 11. I had it as a single, 6th out of 11. This is book 6 in the Rachel Pang series, which is itself a small part of the extended story called A Girl and Her Fed. The Rachel Pang books are relatively straightforward science fiction action thrillers about a group of augmented humans who form a law enforcement agency called OSET. The larger A Girl and Her Fed story is very weird and harder to classify. Anyway, in this one, while still brooding over the end of the previous book, Rachel is sent to New Orleans to help a former agent who has left OSET secretly. Things spiral rapidly out of control, and eventually we have mercenary companies, kidnappings, and rocket launchers. I do like this series and this author quite a bit. Last this month, Of Monsters and Mainframes by Barbara Truelove. Truelove is a nominee for the Astounding Award for Best New Author this year. Storygraph had this at 4.2, 4th out of 11. I had this as a double, 2nd out of 11. Marketing. The official blurb describes it as, quote, "the queer love child of pulp, horror, and classic sci-fi," unquote, which is unusually accurate for a blurb like this. To restore my faith in bad comparisons, USA Today is quoted as saying, quote, "fans of Murderbot will love this quirky sci-fi romp," unquote. I mean, I am a fan of Murderbot, and I basically like this, so I guess they both have unreliable machine narrators, and there's no doubt it's quirky, but sci-fi romp, really? Also, this book is way, way goofier complimentary than Murderbot. In some ways, a good comp is Light from Uncommon Stars, another book that is perfectly happy to have fantasy and science fiction tropes bounce off each other. Light from Uncommon Stars is much darker, though. This book is genuinely unhinged, complimentary. Our viewpoint character is a spaceship, specifically Demeter, a shuttle between Earth and Alpha Centauri. Also, as we start the book, the entire ship's passenger list is being killed by Dracula. Yes, that Dracula. And that is not the only classic movie monster that makes an appearance, but I won't spoil the fun for the rest of you. The book is very aware that we're just here for the ride, so when other monsters show up and the plot gets increasingly ridiculous, it all sort of works. I suspect your mileage here is going to vary based on how much you are willing to put up with Demeter's myopic AI viewpoint. I'm not normally a fan of this. I spend enough time interacting with myopic AI viewpoints. But for some reason, the sheer weirdness of a ship with the whole panoply of MGM horror monsters mostly charmed me. And that's January. We'll be back doing this again in February with another set of books. By February, I mean probably August. Thanks for listening.